Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
I'd like to welcome everybody to Parshas Bishalach 5773. And we have a small intimate group here, so what I have to say is maybe only for the inner circle. I mean, don't say that to everybody else, because they're part of the inner circle too. But I think that the we're trying to do a lesson for any Jew, any time. And what I'm going to say today might seem like it's not for every Jew, but please help me realize that it is for every Jew, and maybe we just need a little bit of courage and a little bit of wisdom and how to convey that. But I'm not going to tell you what it is yet. We're going to do it step by step. All right. Parshas Bishalach, the Parsha of Miracles. Miracles, the splitting of the sea, the manna from heaven, the miraculous victory over Amalek. It is the Parsha of Miracles. And I don't know about you, but that's what I think about when I think of Bishalach. Oh, God was so great, and He made miracles for us to save us and to provide us for our every need. What a great God we have. Back then, when we used to have miracles. It's just a great story to have in our tradition. But what do we really walk away from Parshas Bishalach for any Jew, any time? I mean, it's hard enough to believe it. But even if you believe it, it's great for a story back then, but what do we take out of Bishalach for our time? So perhaps there's a more fundamental concept that we should extract from the Bishalach, and we're just not focusing on it. And because we're not focusing on it, we're not really getting the crux of it, and we're not seeing how it does apply today. And by that I mean, how does the world work? How does the world really run? There's a God, a creator, and He's up there, and we're down here, and there are no miracles. It's just go to work, eat bread, you got a cold, go to the doctor. You know, where... Okay, sometimes we come to the synagogue and we pray to God, but where is the connection between the divine and the otherworldly and this mundane world? Where does success come from? Where does life come from? Where does health come from? That's the kernel, that's the crux that we have to investigate, and we have to take that with us and find out how that still applies today. So I was intrigued by looking for all the sources that there is a connection between the spiritual realm and the physical world. So I was thinking of a verse in Bishalach. The Bishalach is really the Parsha of the Man, the manna. But in Parshas Akev, which is Devarim, chapter 8, verse 3, there is an amazing verse which describes the manna experience. And you have a chumash, that would be Akev 983. Great verse here. Okay, let's start with verse 3. Vaya'ancha vayarivecha. Moshe is recounting all of the travels through the desert, through the 40 years. Vaya'ancha vayarivecha vayachilcha es hamon asher lo yadata v'lo yodun avosecha. Translation, you shall remember, he afflicted you. Okay, verse 3. He afflicted you and let you hunger. Then he fed you the manna that you did not know. Nor did your forefathers know. Why did he feed you that way? Laman hodiacha ki lo al halechem levado yichyeh ha'adam ki al kol motza fi Hashem yichyeh ha'adam. In order to make you know that not by bread alone does man live, rather by everything that emanates from the mouth of God does man live. Not by bread alone does man live, rather by everything that emanates from the mouth of God does man live. Now that's, I don't know about you, that's a very difficult verse to understand. We're contrasting bread with what emanates from the mouth of God. It's not this, rather it's that. Like, these are two separate things. These are two separate realms. And what's the rather? Why doesn't the verse say it's both? Why does the verse say it's not this? It's not bread alone. Rather, it's the mouth of God. How do we put this verse together? And I remember a Peanuts comics when I was young. Man, who's the one that eats a lot? Was there one of the characters that always eats? Or maybe it was maybe it was Archie, and the one who ate a lot was Jughead.
Right.
Still remember my youthful. So Jughead was once eating a big hero sandwich with lots of layers. And they quote, the comic says, man does not live by bread alone. He needs something to put in between the slices. That was the Archie's comic. So I looked up in a wonderful sefer called Shari Aron, which is like an encyclopedia on that shelf of every commentary on every pasuk. Like 25 different sources. And he just quotes verbatim. Sometimes editing, but so here's two explanations of this verse. First is from Ramban. Ramban says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu teaches us that sustenance of man is based on God's decree. That's the verse is saying. Really, life really comes by God's decree, and therefore, If you want to live, observe the commandments. That's what the Ramban says. God is trying to teach us in Egypt, you know, there's no connection between the physical life and the spiritual realm. There is no God. There is no thought of that. So everything is just cause and effect. But I want to teach you that's not the way it works now, but it's all by my decree. Then he quotes something from the Shulah in the name of the Arizal. So we're talking about something more Kabbalistic. I'll get to the message for every Jew at every time, but we're going to do a little Kabbalistic commentary here. Some explain that this verse addresses the long pondered question of the philosophers. How is it? And it could be the Jewish religious philosophers too. How is it that by eating food, our soul is maintained within our body? Right? We know that if a person doesn't eat, then they're going to die of starvation. And if they die of starvation, that means their soul, their neshama, will no longer be connected to their guf. So it comes out that by eating, we're feeding our neshama too. But how does that work? How can food affect the neshama? The neshama doesn't eat. But this is the matter. Food also has a physical and a spiritual component. There is nothing that exists down below that does not have a spiritual energy from above that powers it to work. So, for example, if you have a blade of grass and the blade of grass is growing, there is a spiritual being, a malach or some energy that says, as it were, to the blade of grass, grow. Everything down below has a spiritual counterpart. So therefore, food must also have a spiritual counterpart. And when we eat food, we have a digestive system. You know how the digestive system is able to separate the nutrients from the waste? Well, there is also a spiritual digestive system that extracts the spiritual nourishment from the food, which feeds our neshama, and the physical part of the food goes into the body. And that's the meaning of the pasuk ki lo al halechem levado. It's not just the physicality of the bread on which man lives, but also on the motzah pi Hashem, on the spiritual dimension of the food which nourishes our neshama, and the two together keep us alive. Wow. Food has a spirit, and that's why there's food is a very, you know, ritualistic thing. There's a lot of, we make brachas, we do all kinds of life cycle events with something that's physical, like wine or bread, and it's all part of the body spirit connection. So everything in life, the Rosh Hashanah is telling us, or that the Torah is telling us, that everything in life that's physical also has a spiritual component. Amazing. But it's one thing to read it in a chumash, read it in a Devar Torah and a commentary, but we have to spend our lives pondering this and making it part of our reality. Part of our reality, that there is a spiritual dimension to everything in this physical world, and everything in this physical world, and even our bodies. You have to think about it. I mean, it's something that's very, very vague. Let's take another example from the Parsha, which brings out this point also, the connection between the spiritual and the physical. And that is at the end of the Parsha, when Israel is battling Amalek. And there's something which is just baffling. It may just escape us as we read the story. Joshua, on the very last page, 393. Let's do the page before, 391. Amalek came and battled Israel in Rephidim. Moshe said to Joshua, "Choose people for us and go do battle with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." Joshua did as Moses said to him to do battle with Amalek. Moshe, Aaron, and Hur ascended to the top of the hill. It happened that when Moshe raised his hand, Israel was stronger. And when he lowered his hand, Amalek was stronger. You heard it. And it says Moses' hands grew heavy, so they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, and Aaron and Hur supported his hands. I mean, this whole thing about the hands. What's with the hands? And in fact, the Rashi quotes the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah. It's quoted here on the bottom of 392 in the footnotes. The sages observe, was it Moses' hands that won the battle or lost the battle? We're talking about a war. We're talking about military. We're talking about bows and arrows and spears and elephants and whatever they use, battering rams. Rather, the Torah teaches you, as long as Israel looked heavenward and subjected their heart to their Father in heaven, they would prevail, but when they did not, they would fall. Again, a very close connection between the spiritual realm and the physical realm. So, what I think we should take out of this, and every Jew needs to know this, and this is where we need a little bit of help and creativity, how to take this lesson and communicate it with people. But there's a power in the world, a spiritual power in the world, which emanates from God, and it's everywhere. And it's in our bodies, and it's in our food, and it's in our battlefields. And the question that we really want to walk away with is, how do we access this power? How do we access this power? And I don't recommend trying to do what it does in the Parsha. I don't recommend that we try to go out there and pray for manna. And I don't even recommend that we go out into the next Chas V'Shalom battle and just go like this. I don't recommend it. And I don't think the Torah is trying to tell us that that's what we should do. But the Torah is teaching us through subtle and not such subtle ways that we, Jews, can access this power. And the question is, and this is the question for every Jew at every time, how can we access the spiritual power? Well, we could sit here and ponder it and scratch our heads and say, what is it? But, of course, we know what it is. We know what it is. And this is just an illustration. If we think we don't know what it is, it just illustrates what the Ramchal, Rabbi Luzzatto, says at the very, very beginning of his book. He says, I'm not writing anything that you don't know. However, to the degree that rules are well known and their truth self-evident, they are routinely overlooked or people forget about them altogether. The things that we know the most are the things that we always forget. So, this is no exception. How do we access the power? How do we access the power? So, I will read to you a couple of excerpts from that book for the Shabbos table. Did you get it? From Rabbitson Jungreis's sons? Okay. Vayakasher Yarim Moshe Yadov V'Govar Yisrael. It happened when Moshe raised his hand, Israel was stronger, etc. The Chafetz Chaim points out that the word Yarim is in the future tense. The verse literally means when Moses will raise his hand. Will, in the future. Moses' hand is an allusion to the power of Torah. And we are thus being instructed that whenever we rely on the Torah for our strength, we will prevail. I read from the commentary on the Torah of Rabbi David Feinstein, Shlita, may he live and be well, the son of Rav Moshe Feinstein, who inherited his father's yeshiva in New York. And he has a wonderful, commentary on the Torah. He also gives, and I think his father also, a Parsha class on Friday, like noontime. So we're in good company. The answer is that the Parah Aduma is a metaphor for the Torah itself. He's commenting on the Parsha of Chukas. And Chukas says, this is the statute of the Torah. And it talks about the red heifer. And the red heifer is like something that we don't understand how it works. It's a chok. And the sages say that the Torah is like the red heifer. It's also a chok. So Rabbi Feinstein is elaborating on that. The Parah Aduma is a metaphor for the Torah itself. Water mixed with the ashes of a totally red cow has the power to cleanse someone from the form of tumah, ritual impurity caused by contact with a dead person. This is a supra-rational decree, and we will never be able to understand how or why it works. So also, the Torah has the power to cleanse its followers from many types of impurity. And if one pursues it diligently and with proper intentions, that's a big one, it will transform him or her into a pure and sincere person. Just as we do not and cannot understand the workings of Parah Aduma, we do not understand how Torah study and observance has this purifying effect on individuals. The Parah Aduma purifies a person who is spiritually unclean in a miraculous and almost mystical fashion. We see no apparent nexus between the sprinkling of the ashes upon the person and the spiritual transformation that ensues. In the same manner, the study of Torah affects an equally astounding transformation in a person without any external clue as to what is happening or why. Yet we have, prima facie, evidence of this metamorphosis in the thousands of Baalei Teshuvah who have radically modified their character traits as a result of Torah study. It's miraculous. And doesn't this make sense? If God can transmit spirituality through food, which just goes into our digestive system, can't he transmit spirituality and energy and strength through our minds and our hearts? We have minds and hearts, and they're very sophisticated. And he gave us the Torah information to feed into our minds and our hearts. Isn't it bound to allow that divine energy to flow in and to become part of us? So do we realize that Torah study isn't just for interest, getting a good education? Don't we see that Kihem Chayenu V'Orech Yomenu, that it is our life and the length of our days? This same article about Rebbetzin Jungreis tells the story of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Zatzal. He was one of the European Torah scholars that came to America and helped establish Torah communities here. And he lived to 93, 94, and he was very health conscious. And today, Yibar Olachaim, his son Rav Shmuel and his Rebbetzin are very health conscious. And they're also, Rav Shmuel, you should see, running around in late 80s and getting on airplanes and flying to Atlanta and flying to Australia and Russia to help with communal matters. Anyway, Rav Yaakov, who was very health conscious, was once told by his doctor, "You're working too hard, you need to take a break. I don't even want you studying Torah." Mm-hmm. And when you say that the doctor said it's unhealthy, that meant a lot to Rav Yaakov. So one day, during his hiatus, he's sitting and he's reading a Sefer. So his wife or whoever it was says, "But the doctor said it's not good for you." He says, "And if the doctor tells me not to breathe, should I listen to him too? Torah is our air. So I can't completely stop studying Torah. Torah is our air." Alan Smirin told me. He says, "I want to give you a real life example." He was, this is my friend, he spent 4 months with some type of some type of digestive bacteria, something that really turned his system upside down. He was very weak and not doing well for 4 months. And he had to keep working, but he said he was in bad shape. And he said that what kept him going, every morning he sits down and he reads his Torah books. He says that is literally what kept him going. So I don't think this is homiletics, and I don't think it's hyperbole, but the Torah, this is what we have to learn from this Parsha. And we have to figure out a way to share this with every Jew at any time, that we have access to divine power. We have access to the Creator. And even though we're living in a time when there are no open miracles, and the greatest source of that strength and that power is through the study of Torah in a way that's meaningful for us, that's on our level, and that, as Rabbi Feinstein says, that if we pursue it diligently with proper intentions, it can transform us. And this is exactly what Rav Noach Weinberg was trying to do. He was trying to convince everybody, every Jew, that what we really need is wisdom. Now, I know he made it sound like he was luring them to success. He said, he used to give lectures, and he would say, you know, these people that came from no Jewish background whatsoever, he says, "What do you want in life? You want to be rich? I'll teach you how you can be rich. You want to be successful? You want to have a good marriage? You want to have good kids? I'm going to teach you how to do it. I'm going to teach you the 48 ways to wisdom." That wasn't a come on. That wasn't just a good advertising technique. He's saying, "I'm going to give you connection to the divine power." And here it is. And this is what Rav Noach wrote in the introduction. I looked online to get his own words. It says, this is from the author, "Wisdom. It's the key to unravel the profoundly complex maze of life, the guidepost that leads to the actualization and fulfillment to which we all aspire. Yet when we think of it, we're likely to conjure up the image of bent old men with graying beards and world-weary eyes. Indeed, it appears that wisdom is acquired only after life has been lived, when it's no longer necessary. In truth, this is only an illusion, like so many other false perceptions we have of life that don't bear proper scrutiny. The way to acquire wisdom is open to all. You just have to follow the lead of those who came before you. Our sages have mapped out strategies to acquire wisdom in 48 distinct ways, as enumerated in Pirkei Avos. Well, maybe that's not Rav Noach's words, because it says, HaRav Noach Weinberg Shlita Rosh Yeshiva of Eish HaTorah has taken these 48 ways and, based on the myriad commentaries of our rabbis, has distilled them into a comprehensive, systematic program to help one maximize his potentials. In fact, to help one become wise before it's too late. So, that's what we want to do. We want to figure out a way on how to, first of all, realize ourselves what power we have, and how it's for everybody, and it's for everybody's good, and everybody should want it. We're not trying to shove anything down someone's throat. We're offering them power. Period. Divine power. Does anybody have any ideas? That's all I have to say.
Just that this is the Shabbat of Tu B'Shvat.
Yes.
Every fruit from Eretz Yisrael, you get a lot of for appreciating the fruits of Eretz Yisrael. The Meraglim did not appreciate the fruit of Eretz Yisrael. They said, these fruits are like giant size, and there's a problem with this country. Why is everything giant size?
Mm-hmm.
They talked against Eretz Yisrael, so you get a lot of merit, particularly for enjoying the fruits of Eretz Yisrael. And Kabbalistically, each fruit has got a different segula, like a different bracha that it offers you.
In light of what we learn from the Shla, this makes perfect sense, because if indeed spirituality is transmitted through food, and Eretz Yisrael is the most spiritual land, that means the fruits of Eretz Yisrael are endowed with greater spiritual powers. And so when we say the seven fruits of Israel, we're not just saying, you know, these are delicious fruits. But we're saying these have particular spiritual energy attached to them. Wonderful. And to denigrate Israel and to say that we don't want to go there is like saying we don't want power. We don't want to connect with the source of our power.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, of course. I knew it. But the Torah, somebody once said, how come the Torah was given in the desert? How come it wasn't given, Mount Moriah? Why didn't God take us into Israel and give us the Torah? Because the Torah is so powerful that it is our energy source wherever we are. Because God knew that the Jews would be in exile. And he wanted to give us the ultimate access to power that's not dependent on being in the land. When we're in the land, we have access to that spiritual energy in different ways. Through the temple, through the pilgrimage, through the fruits of Israel, through the special mitzvos of Israel. But you always have access to the Torah, and that's why I'm giving it out in the desert, in a God-forsaken place like Mount Sinai. But we're sitting on a gold mine, and every Jew can have access to it. Especially today, there are books, there are materials that will explain Torah concepts at whatever level of sophistication or simplicity that you need, whatever level of observance, any person will find that the Torah speaks to them. They just have to try it. I looked at the very first of the 48 ways in Rav Noach's own words in the transcript. And it's all about growing. When you study Torah, you grow. Listen to what he writes. This we didn't have in ours. Who should be growing more? You as an adult, as a 25-year-old, 35, 45, or a kid who's only two. You say a two-year-old. Let's see if you're right. A two-year-old toddler is beautiful. You think it's so cute when he comes to you and announces that there is Wawa in his nappy. You are proud that he can perceive that his diaper is wet. You know that he's only one step away from being toilet trained. But if the same kid comes to you when he's 10 and says the same cute thing, you know that you're witnessing a tragedy. He hasn't grown one bit in all that time. Now, a 10-year-old who is normal is a beautiful thing to see. If you see him again at age 18 doing the same things that he did when he was 10, then it's a tragedy. You see, the same can be said for any age. A 25-year-old is great. But if by age 45 he hasn't grown or moved forward and is still acting like he's 25, tragedy. The biggest tragedy is when he is 65, and not only is he not moving forward, he's starting to regress into senility. So you see how the number one of the 48 ways aims to prevent this kind of tragedy. It teaches you to undertake one thing for the rest of your life and study it. That was Rav Noach's campaign. Find a subject that you like and become an expert in it. Study it. Once you get the hang of your one thing, then you can add two or three more. The idea is to grow in your awareness of life, to be aware at every moment. Make that commitment and see what happens. So he was trying to teach any Jew at any time that we've got the access to the greatest power.
But the thing is, you see, if you could just live in the desert and live on dates and not eat very much or be bothered with the material world at all, then that's one thing. But God says, I'm going to bring you into the land of Israel and you're going to farm it and
right.
You're going to think that it's your effort.
Right.
But it isn't. It's my hand.
It took the training. That's probably why, you know what? This made me think of something. The Jews didn't want to go into the land of Israel. And some explained that they didn't want to lose that spiritual connection. And therefore, they said, if we go into Israel, we may separate the two. And God said, well, if you're not ready, you're not ready. So I see that you need to learn this about the spiritual connection for longer. So he kept us in the desert for 40 more years. More manna, more clouds of glory, more spirituality that you can touch. And then he says, now are you ready? Because that's the goal. The goal is to go into the physical place and to still see that we're connected to the spiritual source. But it took more and more training. So, you know, even in our experience today of people that have, you know, raised sons and daughters that have seemed to opt for a life of austerity and deprivation so that they can, you know, have that just this pure spiritual Torah study. Let's put that into context. I mean, I did that too. And our parents thought we were wacko. But we went to Israel as a married couple, which wasn't done that much in those days. We were only there for a year. But it really is. It's kind of filling up and getting that, because in today's, you know, it's hard to get it from the outside world. And it has filled me with that appreciation that I can go out into the world and I see it everywhere. But not without continuous nourishment. We have to continuously nourish that connection. We have to continue to study. We have to continue to be around people that value it, that want to study it with you, that want to learn it, and that people that you can learn from. There's always people ahead of you, and there's always people below you. And doing it together as a community, this is what we're trying to do. But there's power. And I don't think, you know, Rav Weinberg Zatzal said to me, Rav Yaakov Weinberg, he said, he was speaking on the theoretical plane, he said, the more Torah you learn, the more you will help Klal Yisroel. It's power. Torah is pure power, pure energy, and we don't know how it works, but it works. And it's open to all of us. Yes.
So it's like the more full the vessel becomes, it has to be empty in order to be able to keep filling up.
Mm.
So
why does it have to empty?
Because because that's what this is. I'm a vehicle or a vessel. So what I take in is to share.
The Talmud says the opposite. The Talmud says that the spiritual dimension is different than the physical dimension. In the physical dimension, an empty vessel can receive and a full vessel cannot.
Mm-hmm.
And in the spiritual dimension, an empty vessel cannot receive and a full vessel can. So I've had this long-standing debate with one of my dear friends that I've been studying with. And he, it's a man, and he has maintained, and he's getting this from some type of Eastern thinking, that you have to make yourself like an empty vessel. And all of this kind of Eastern stuff. You have to meditate and lose yourself and be nothing, and be empty. Now, I don't know if this is what you're referring to.
No.
But you have to fill yourself, you know.
It has to do with being able to give over to someone else.
How can you
maybe
learn Torah and not
hold
want
on to
share
everything?
It.
See, that's it.
That's
the thing is to be able to give it over. Right.
Yeah.
So what do you mean empty out?
But you're not losing it.
Oh, you
no,
mean
no,
empty
no,
out
no,
means
no.
Spilling over.
You're
yeah.
a conduit. You're a
so,
conduit.
So,
thank you.
So
yes.
The way,
you are a conduit
the
for your Torah.
The way that I was
it's
taught.
It's more like electricity. That just keep.
It's like a cup.
It has to go somewhere.
It's
it
like
can't
a cup
just
shefa.
Stay here.
What is the word for one who influences? It's called a mashpia.
Uh-huh.
And the Chafetz Chaim says that a mashpia means overflowing. So if you fill up this cup all the way to the top, and you just keep on filling it and filling it, just overflows. In fact, one time, I'll share a story from my youth. One time, some friends and I and my brother had a music band, and we once skipped yeshiva. Now we were very good about it. We left Friday at 12 o'clock noon, right after class. And we got into the car, we drove 5 hours down to Norfolk, Virginia, and we were going to be playing music at an NTSY Shabbaton. And we didn't miss any class, and then right after shot, we played on Saturday night, and we got back into the car, we drove 5 hours through the night, we got back like at 8 in the morning. And we walked into the yeshiva, like so proud of ourselves that we didn't miss anything. But in class that day, we all fell asleep. Because we couldn't keep our eyes open. So then we took a nap, and then we came back to the yeshiva in the afternoon, and the Rebbe was waiting. And he pulled me aside, and he said, "Where were you?" And I said, "Well, we went to do outreach." So then he told me this explanation of the Chafetz Chaim. He said, "Now, there's two ways to get that liquid out of this cup. You can pour it this way, and liquid will come out. But whatever comes out is going to be making the cup emptier. Or you can start filling the cup and filling it until it gets to the top and then keep filling it and then it overflows. And the cup never loses what it has." So he says, "I want you," this made my life. He says, "I want you to be a mashpia. I want you to help other people grow. But first make sure that you're full and that you're overflowing. Not that you're emptying yourself out." And that was the Chafetz Chaim's mashal.
So how could you teach until you anybody and do outreach at all?
So that was an interesting, if you want to hear this interesting historical note, that was the difference between Rav Yaakov Weinberg and Rav Noach Weinberg. They didn't disagree. I asked once Rebbetzin Feldman if her father and her uncle saw eye to eye, and she said, "Absolutely." But their approaches were different. Rav Yaakov said, "You stay in yeshiva for a long time, and you get mature, and then maybe you'll go out and teach." But we know that Rav Noach would get somebody into his yeshiva, and make him into a Baal Teshuva, and in a couple of years, now you got to go and live over there and help other people. Well, were they full? I don't know. I think he did it. I think he made them full, but. The point, but she said that they were dealing with different individuals, different situations. The principle was the same. But that's what Rav Yaakov said. He said, "The more you learn, the more you'll be able to help others."
Mm-hmm.
With that power, and that's the dynamics of this power that we have. Amazing. Okay, have a great Shabbat.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.